Hey, Mike. Well, we got something new here, sponsorship with probably our favorite software, you know, and according to a recent survey, 30% of evangelical churchgoers want more in-depth teaching like we do here at the Naked Bible Podcast. And if you want to go deeper, and there's nothing better than we trust in Logos, it's the Bible study platform, period.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Logos, having worked there a long time, I mean, I know Logos uses powerful technology with biblical resources. I mean, you can access Bibles and search tools, commentaries, seminary-level courses now with Mobile Ed, and even audiobooks right on your phone, tablet, or desktop.
Yeah, and they have over 200,000 digital books. It's crazy. I mean, the power, the technology, yeah, and the search, and all the cross-references. I honestly don't know how you could go to the depth that you can get studying the Bible if you don't use Logos software.
Well, I think that's the point. You can't. There's no other platform like it. I can remember when I worked there, when we crossed 100,000 resources, but now it's double, you know, since I've even been there. So what the difference is that Logos editions of books have been turbocharged with powerful data that connect them with the rest of your library. So everything in the library is completely interconnected. This is not like an ebook or a Kindle book or a PDF or anything like that. It's so far beyond that that people don't really realize it until they've actually gotten into it. So whether you're comparing Bible translations or tackling tough topics, studying deep theological issues, Logos is going to have you covered no matter what. And then that's before you even get to original language resources. And one of the crucial tools in Logos are the reverse interlinears, where you don't even have to know Greek and Hebrew to run searches in Greek and Hebrew, tap into the original languages. And Logos will even help you pronounce the words.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, if you're preparing a sermon or a Bible study, I don't know how you don't use Logos to get your study done.
Yeah, I use it literally. I use it every day. I use it hours every day. No exaggeration. I use Logos every day. I'm very familiar with it. I mean, people know that. And there's just nothing like it on the planet.
I mean, if you're serious about Bible study, there's no other software tool out there that will get you as deeper than Logos.
Yep. And I'm asked all the time in email about Bible study tools. And having been on the podcast for all these years, how many times have you heard me say you need to invest in resources? If you're serious about Bible study, you must invest in resources and tools. And this is it. And I get asked all the time, you know, this question, my answer is always the same. You need to get Logos. And, you know, people sometimes balk at, you know, the affordability question here, because Logos packages, there's so much in them and they can be expensive. But now, Logos is more than affordable. You can get started for just $49. And that's always what I tell people. Get into the platform low and then spend extra money on the books and resources that you want. And now is the perfect time to do that. Just $49.
Yes. And if you want to support the Naked Bible Podcast and what we do here, please go get the Logos software now at logos.com/NakedBible for $49. Get started. And like Mike said, you can build up your library over time, but there's no better time than now to support our show and Logos by going to logos.com/NakedBible for $49. You can get started right now, Mike. So we encourage all of our listeners, go do it, and you'll be thankful that you did.
Yep, absolutely.
You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 433, the Epistle of Jude, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. yep. anticipating the new season, such as it is, two episodes of Stranger Things.
Yeah, yeah. It came out last weekend, so by the time the show airs, we will probably both have watched it. So I'm just going to go ahead and assume that it's good. So I liked it.
Yeah, I don't know. It might take us a while to get to it, but who knows? Yeah. It just depends on what the kids want to do.
Yeah, it's strange having like Halloween during 4th of July. That's a crazy mixed emotion there.
But yeah, it is kind of weird.
It's fun. Not a whole lot of fireworks going on here for the 4th of July. We hope everybody that's in America had a good 4th of July. We had big wildfires, Mike, and everything burned around us, so I don't think we're really going to do fireworks this year. Yeah, Texas has been on fire for a little bit. Fortunately, we got the fires out, but I had ash raining down in my backyard, so it was too close for comfort, for sure. But yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. Well, Mike, I got an email from one of our listeners, Mark and his wife, Kim. He emailed me and said they finally caught up to all of the episodes, and it only took them 4 years. I want to welcome them to the present. Yeah, enjoyed those emails.
They deserve some kind of medal for that.
I know, and they're probably sad because I can only imagine if you're binging all this good stuff and then you catch up and you got to wait every week for an episode to come out. That's pretty rough. I know how it is when we binge, Stranger Things or anything. You want to watch them all now, so it's not as much fun.
Yeah, that's true.
But
that's
you could go back and listen to them again, I guess. There's several of them that are worthy.
Yeah, you can pick them out,
All right, Mike. Well, here we are in Jude, part two. I'm excited about this one because didn't you mention you're going to have some more Unseen Realm content in this particular episode? And
yep, we're going to go a little bit beyond Unseen Realm in this episode. So we're going to focus on Jude 4 and 5, those two verses. We got into verse 4. A little bit on the previous episode in the characterization of the false teachers, but we'll hit a little bit more. There's one thing I sort of saved, just for this week, and then go on into verse 5. But let's just start by reading verse 4, and then when we get to verse 5, then that'll be evident. So Jude 4 says, I might as well read verses 3 and 4 just so to flavor the context here. Beloved, although I was very eager to write to you about our common salvation, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. For certain people have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were designated for this condemnation, ungodly people who pervert the grace of our God into sensuality and deny our only Master and Lord Jesus Christ. On that, the part of verse 4 that I reserved for today, for this episode, is this line, long ago were designated for this condemnation. This is ESV, so what ESV translates as were designated is a perfect passive participle of prographo, which, more literally, if we were going to be real literalistic about this translation, it would read, certain people have crept in unnoticed who had or have been written about long ago for this condemnation. So the question is this some kind of note about predestination, or is it a prophetic prediction, or is it more or less just Jude saying, hey, these people are going to reap what they sow? I think it's certainly right to say that the predestination idea is not self-evident in this. This is not, prographo is not the normal verb choice for predestination, like in certain passages in Romans. So it's not self-evident at all. The verb choice seems to indicate he's thinking about a type of people that his audience have been forewarned about. And so that would raise the question of, well, where were they forewarned? I'm going to quote again from Gene Green's commentary on Jude, one of the commentaries on Jude that I like. And he writes, Jude's use of prographo, to write in advance, appears to point to the way their doom was prophetically predicted. And he cross-references Romans 15:4 here for the similar use of the verb. This verb, however, is not commonly employed in the context of predictive prophecy, but in the literature of the era, it repeatedly arises in legal contexts. The verb is attached to the concept of making official decrees, either in marriage contracts, deeds of sale, or public notes. The substantives programma and prographe are the official decrees or notices themselves. And then he cites LSJ, which is the Liddell Scott lexicon, and BDAG, which is the Bauer, Donker, Arndt, and Gingrich lexicon, and Moulton and Milligan, that lexicon for the vocabulary of the Greek New Testament. So there's lots of examples of this in legal contexts. Back to Green, he says, Jude's emphasis is not simply that the doom of the heretics was predicted, but also that it was decreed and publicly announced. While the predictive sense is not absent entirely, his principal point concerns the official and public condemnation of the heretics. And that's the end of the quotation. I'm going to throw in another quote here from Herb Bateman's commentary, because he adds some important details to this. Herb writes, "This descriptive clause has at least two baffling interpretive challenges. To begin with, Jude alludes to written material. That's the hoi pragegramene, or pragegramenoi, excuse me, those who were written about in that whole line about these intruders. Furthermore, this material was written at some point in the past, and that's indicated by the Greek word palai, which is typically means long ago. Was Jude speaking of direct prophecies written specifically about these certain people, or was he speaking of godless patterns of rebellious behavior traceable in written texts? Some commentators suggest Jude refers to books in heaven." And I'll just stop there. If you remember back in the Naked Bible podcast history, we did a whole episode on the heavenly books, or the Book of Life, you know, the heavenly tablets. And some of those, you know, were just as Herb is describing here, about things done or condemnation for certain works. He references here examples in 1 Enoch 81, 1 Enoch 89, 1 Enoch 104, 1 Enoch 106, Revelation 20, 12, Jubilees 5, 13, so on and so forth. So then he continues to write, "Others propose Jude references godless people in other New Testament texts. Paul, for instance, predicts that, quote, fierce wolves will come in among you, even from among your own group, unquote. And that's 1 Timothy 4, 1 through 3, but you could throw in 2 Timothy 3, 13, and a host of other references that he has here. You'll also get this in early patristics, early church fathers like Ignatius and the Didache, this notion, again, of Jude referencing godless people that would arise from within. So Herb writes here, "Still others put forward the idea that Jude alludes to prophetic material in the Old Testament, specifically Isaiah 37, 26 and Isaiah 48, 5. Isaiah 37, 26 says, "Have you not heard that I determined that long ago I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you should make fortified cities crash into heaps of ruins?" So, you know, that's an allusion to, again, a prediction in the Old Testament about what happens with bad behavior. And the same thing is there for Isaiah 48:5. So similar idea. So Herb writes, "Jude is not necessarily specifying a specific written text, but rather people who long ago were written about and thereby appear frequently in Jewish literature. For instance, Jude is about to call his readers to remember three different patterns of past rebellions and God's diverse judgments of them: the Exodus generation, angelic beings, and Gentile urban centers." That's in Jude 5 through 7, is where Herb is saying, you know, Jude is going to get into some of these things from the Old Testament that were, again, typological. They showed patterns of behavior and what happens. Herb continues and says, "Second, Jude is also about to apply three other assorted patterns of rebellion by three men from the past to these dubious intruders and tell of God's forthcoming condemnation of their rebellion: Cain, Balaam, and Korah." That's Jude 11 through 13. "Thus, Jude may merely employ a form of ancient typology as a means to point out the ungodly characteristics of these, quote-unquote, certain people. Yet it seems very likely Jude has a particular text in mind. For example, 1 Enoch 1:9, because he alludes to it in Jude 14 through 15. Thus, it would appear that Jude has both a written source and specific godless people, speaking typologically, in purview. It's the end of Herb's quote. So the point here is that it's clear Jude references specific texts and that he references Old Testament typological groups or individuals elsewhere in his epistle. I mean, Herb just gave us the verse numbers, Jude 5 through 7, Jude 11 through 13, Jude 14 and 15. So that helps inform us here in verse 4 about how to read what he says. Jude is looking at some texts, either in the Old Testament or the pseudepigrapha, probably both, that predict the downfall of such people and uses Old Testament analogies or types to make that point. Again, for those for who typology might be not a working part of their vocabulary or their biblical knowledge, a type is like a predictive thing that it's not verbal prophecy, it's nonverbal prophecy. It's a particular person or institution or event that foreshadows something yet to come. And in this case, you know, Jude is picking on some specific characters in the Old Testament, you know, Cain and Balaam, for instance, and Korah. And he's also referencing, you know, verses about what happens, you know, with this kind of, you know, wanton self-destructive behavior. That's the end to which it's going to lead. So this is what Jude's doing. He's not saying that all of this was predetermined or preordained, but he's using, again, Old Testament passages and maybe, you know, a pseudepigrapha passage and certainly Old Testament types to, again, foreshadow that, hey, you all should know that false teachers like this, you should already know what their destiny is, again, because of this material. So let's move to Jude 5. And Jude 5 says this: "Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe." Now, if you think about that, that's a shocking statement because it puts Jesus in the Old Testament. Jesus is the one who gets credit here in Jude 5 for saving the people, saving the Old Testament. You know, some texts will say it's Yahweh, some texts will say it's Elohim, some texts will say it's Hapanim, the presence. Other texts will say it's Hamalach, the angel of the Lord. And so I would often ask, you know, well, which one is correct? And the answer is all of them. But Jude here is saying that Jesus is in that mix. Now, we could say that the angel of the Lord, and again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know this is where I'm at for good reason, that the angel of the Lord was the pre-incarnate appearance of one of the persons of the Godhead, specifically the second person of the Godhead, you know, before we had the incarnation, before we had Jesus of Nazareth. So there's an immediate connection right there, but the connection is explicit here in Jude 5. "I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe." Now, the issue here, again, other than just the impact of the statement, because it would be a strong statement of the pre-existence of Christ, is that there's a text-critical issue here. Not all manuscripts say Jesus. Some say Lord. Some have something else, but a number of them do have Jesus here. So there's a text-critical issue. That if you look this up, some of these resources will be familiar. And if you don't know Greek, then the go-to source for this kind of thing is the Net Bible Notes. The Net Bible goes with Jesus. That's the reading it adopts. And there's a note here I'm going to read in a moment that'll explain why. The SBLGNT, the SBL Greek New Testament, reads Jesus, again, for those who can read Greek and use that material. Interestingly enough, Jesus is not in the Nestle-Aland 27. That's another version of the Greek New Testament that is often used in seminaries and schools. However, the following edition, Nestle-Aland 28, adopts it. It says Jesus. And the same thing happened with the United Bible Society Greek New Testament, again, that's used a lot in schools. The fourth edition did not have Jesus. It had Kurios. It had Lord, like the old NA 27. But both the NA 28 and the United Bible Society fifth version have Jesus, Jesus. So this has strong textual support. And again, it has, I would say, strong contextual support if you're aware of the two powers stuff, the two Yahwehs idea from the Old Testament. Again, if you've not read Unseen Realm, you need to. And I can't rehearse all this data in a podcast episode, but it would be chapters 16 through 18 in Unseen Realm. The Net Bible quotation, let's read that. Here's what they say about it. They say, the reading Jesus, Jesus, is deemed too hard by several scholars, since it involves the notion of Jesus acting in the early history of the nation Israel. However, not only does this reading enjoy the strongest support from a variety of early textual witnesses, they give a few examples, it's the manuscript numbers and so on and so forth, but two of the main ones that we've referenced before in incidences like this are the text known as Alexandrinus and another one known as Vaticanus. These are two very old codexes of the Greek New Testament. So Jesus is in both of those. But the Net Bible goes on to say it's not only in a variety of early textual witnesses, but the plethora of variants, the plethora of alternate readings, demonstrate that scribes were uncomfortable with it. That's an indication to textual critics that scribes would run into this and not know what to do with it because it was so shocking. So that argues for its originality. And the Net Bible says the scribes were uncomfortable with it because they seemed to exchange Kurios, Lord, or Theos, God, for Jesus in other manuscripts. And it notes that the early papyrus, P72, has the intriguing reading Theos Christos, God Christ, for Jesus. So text critically, again, we're not going to lapse into a lecture on textual criticism and how textual critics think, but generally speaking, if it's a hard, difficult reading, it's to be preferred because the argument is that it's an argument for originality because scribes would tend to make things easier or less complicated than more complicated. You know, a scribe wouldn't deliberately complicate his text. He would add something to smooth something out or to explain something. Since you see a lot of that here in Jude 5, it's a good argument for Jesus being original. So this is a very strong argument for Christ's pre-existence here in Jude 5. So for those of you who are, you know, having conversations with people or maybe doing a little bit of apologetics, you know, don't be deterred by the fact that some manuscripts don't have Kurios. A couple of very old ones and very good ones do. And again, text critically, all your major editions of the Greek New Testament that are available today adopt Jesus as the original reading here. If you're really into this kind of subject, you can handle some Greek and you have access to maybe some scholarly material like the journals. There was a fairly recent article, it's 2008, by Philip Bartolome, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the last name correctly. It's Bartholome with an umlaut over it. So my apologies to Philip if I get his last name wrong, but Philip Bartolome. And the article is entitled, Did Jesus Save the People Out of Egypt? And the subtitle is A Reexamination of a Textual Problem in Jude 5. It's from the scholarly journal Novum Testamentum, Volume 50, and that's 2008, pages 143 to 158. And his conclusion is that, yeah, this is original. This is the best reading. And he marshals lots of data and lots of, you know, again, reasoning behind it in this recent article. But again, all of your major Greek New Testament editions, NA28, the most recent, UBS 5, SBLGNT, they all read Jesus. They all read Jesus here. Now, a few observations that are kind of interesting before we get into the bonus material beyond Unseen Realm, because I mentioned this verse in Unseen Realm, but I don't really say anything about it. There are those who would argue, let's go back and read the verse, just so it's fresh in your mind. Now, I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. Some people would point out, hey, you know, Old Testament Joshua, the Old Testament character Joshua in the Septuagint, his name is Jesus. So maybe this is referring to just Joshua, just plain old Joshua. And Jude is saying, now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Joshua saved people out of the land of Egypt and afterward destroyed those who did not believe. But the question is obvious. Did Joshua do that? Did he? What does it mean he destroyed a people who afterward did not believe? But more importantly, think about the verse. He says here that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. If you keep reading, in verse 6, you read this. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he, that is the Jesus, the Jesus of verse 5, has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. Again, I've got news for you. Joshua didn't do that. Joshua did not ensure that the angels who sinned, back in Genesis 6, were kept in chains of gloomy darkness. Jesus did. I take this comment in verse 6, that he kept the angels in prison, and referring back grammatically to Jesus in verse 5, I take this as another indication, another reference to the 1 Peter 3 scenario. And again, I didn't say that in Unseen Realm. I did deal with 1 Peter 3 a lot. If you remember, this is 1 Peter 3, 14 through 22. And I'm just going to read a little, little sections of it, because, again, we don't have time to repeat all the content in Unseen Realm and so on and so forth in previous episodes. But this is the passage where in verse 18, we read this: Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey, when God's patience waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through water. Okay, I think Jude 6 is actually referring to this same scenario, that Christ, when he suffers and dies, he goes into the underworld. And this is where all of the traditions, all the New Testament passages like 2 Peter 2 and here in Jude 6, they have the angels that sinned back in Genesis 6 imprisoned. And Christ goes and preaches to them. And you say, well, what does he preach? Well, again, the short version, because I'm not going to just quote Unseen Realm at length here, is he preaches to them their doom, that they're not going to get out of the netherworld. They're doomed forever until the day of the end when they're annihilated finally. If you recall 1 Peter 3, a lot of people, this was the passage where I actually visited a church where the pastor stood up right in the middle of a series in 1 Peter and said, this is what we're supposed to be preaching today, 1 Peter 3, 14 through 22, and it's so weird, I'm just going to skip it. And he did. He didn't even try. And what unlocks this passage is to realize that 1 Peter 3 uses Enoch, the person of Enoch, as a type, as typology, again, a foreshadowing of things to come about Jesus. In the same way that Paul uses Adam as a type in Romans 5, becomes a prefiguring figure. And that's really important because you have to know the story of Genesis 6 and the sins of the sons of God called the Watchers in Genesis 6. Called the Watchers in the book of Enoch, but they're the sons of God of Genesis 6. You have to know the Enochian story to appreciate what Peter is saying in 1 Peter and in 2 Peter 2 and here in Jude 5 and 6. So it presupposes that the people know the story, because it's in that story that the angels that sinned back in Genesis 6 are enchained in Tartarus. Peter actually, 2 Peter actually uses that term explicitly. They're put into Tartarus. A lot of English translations have they're sent to Hades or something like that. The Greek verb is tartarao. They are sent to Tartarus, which is where the titans of Greek religion get sent. And they're giant figures. They get sent. They're completely supernatural. Some of the titans are also giants. But this is where they get punished, where they get imprisoned in the Greek stories in their own religion. So it's very clear that, again, this is what happens to the sons of God of Genesis 6, who can call the Watchers in 1 Enoch. And this has an ancient Mesopotamian, antecedent as well, that goes beyond the Greek material, goes beyond Enoch, goes beyond, this other material we've cited. But the original backstory for Genesis 6 is the Apkallu tradition. This is where the Apkallu are sent after they violate, they transgress, just like in the manner of Genesis 6. cohabiting with human women to preserve the knowledge of Babylon in the Apkallu story, preserve the knowledge and civilization of Babylon. They're punished by the higher gods by being sent to the Abzu, the pit, the watery, abyss forever to never return. So the antecedents, the context, the cognate material is all consistent here. And I realize a lot of people listening, they don't want to have anything to do with Genesis 6, and they're going to opt for something like the Sethite view, which is among the dumbest Bible interpretations I've ever heard for any passage. But, that's where people go because this is just too strange. It's too weird. Like the guy who said, we're just going to skip this morning, Sunday morning, the pastor, and by golly, he did it. He just skipped it. We moved on. But you don't need to do that. If you understand the Enoch story from the book of Enoch, and Jude is going to quote Enoch, he's going to allude to parts of Enoch elsewhere in this very tiny epistle. But here, it's a very clear allusion to the Enoch story, and he's actually using Enoch as a type of Jesus, because in the Enoch story, when the watchers sin and get sent to their prison, then they're sorry. They're sorry for what they did, transgressing heaven and earth, so to speak, like they did. And they solicit Enoch because Enoch was, taken to heaven and he's favored with God and so on and so forth. They solicit Enoch to intercede for them with God on their behalf to let them out. And Enoch does. Enoch goes to God and says, hey, the watchers down here, down in the abyss, they want some clemency. They're repentant, they say, and they want to be forgiven, and they want to be left out. And God said, go back and tell them no. They're there until the end of days. And so Enoch descends to the underworld to announce their doom. And that's what Peter is using in 1 Peter 3 to typify Christ. Christ goes down there and tells the powers of darkness that they've lost. They're defeating me here in the underworld because I'm Jesus, the Son of God, but I'm out of here soon. Jesus leaves the grave, that you have the resurrection, which 1 Peter 3, if we'd have kept reading, mentions the resurrection. Because of the resurrection, he's no longer held captive to death, and they're still there. That's the whole point of 1 Peter 3, and then Peter loops baptism into it. In Unseen Realm, I talk about how baptism is like a loyalty oath. It's spiritual warfare because it's a reminder not only to the people watching of whose side you're on, but it's a reminder to the powers of darkness that they're defeated. So all of this is going on in the backdrop. So we don't have the Old Testament Joshua here. What we have here is, again, Jesus. We have this reference specifically to him, and he's the one who kept the angels that sinned in chains. He announces to them their doom. So I actually think we have a nice support here for the first Peter 3 interpretation that I laid out in Unseen Realm. And it's not my interpretation. Again, nothing in Unseen Realm is original to me. This is a long, time-tested, view of what's going on in 1 Peter 3. The longest scholarly exposition of it is Dalton's book. Again, if you read Unseen Realm, you can look it up in the bibliography. I'm not going to rabbit trail any further on it. But again, I didn't include that in Unseen Realm. And I think it's an important, kind of a neat thing to include here as we're talking about the book of Jude. Second observation, what about the line, afterward destroyed those who did not believe? So let's read the verse one more time. Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. The term translated afterward is deuteron, which means second or secondly, if you're taking it adverbially. So what does this incident refer to? Who are those who did not believe? If it's the Egyptians, then the angel of the Lord, again, the Old Testament second Yahweh figure, second power, second person of the Trinity figure, who is equatable with Jesus in the New Testament context, then it would be he's both a deliverer of Israel, and he's also the death angel. Though, if you're talking about the Egyptians, it would be the Egyptians either who die at Passover or who are judged in the Red Sea. And so either way, and you say, well, is the death angel associated with the Red Sea judgment? He is. And again, you could read my angels book for this in my discussion of the destroyer, the Mashkit, who, again, indications are in the Psalms that this is the angel of Yahweh. It's Yahweh himself in the form of this angel. So again, there's a good argument to be made there, and Jude could be picking up on it. And it would be very consistent with having this angel of the Lord figure be both the deliverer and the destroyer. You could also ask, well, what if those who did not believe are the Israelites later on, certain judgment episodes, like, you know, when it's not really a judgment episode, but I'm thinking of Exodus 16 with the manna. No, nobody dies there. They're not judged. But you know, all along the way to the promised land, they have these episodes of grumbling and complaining. And on certain occasions, God judges the people. The most obvious candidate for this is the rebellion of Korah in Numbers 16. Well, that's also a good indicator of this second Yahweh figure being the destroyer because of the Targums. And I have to stop here and launch into, again, my third point here, the third observation, has to do with the Targums, you know, the two powers precedent in the Targums. But you might say, what in the world's a Targum? What are the Targums? Targum is a Hebrew word. It's also used in Aramaic, meaning translation. And it is used especially for Aramaic translations of the Hebrew scriptures that were read in the synagogues on the Sabbath and on feast or fast days. Scholars usually assume that this practice of translating the Hebrew Bible for people, was necessitated by the loss of Hebrew fluency by Jews growing up in exile. Now, that's actually a quotation from John Ronning's book, Jewish Targums and John's Logos Theology. Remember, John refers to Jesus as the Word of the Lord. Now, that also has, you know, Old Testament precedent. We'll get to it in a minute, just reviewing that. But it was the practice in Jesus' day and before, where after the return from exile, which is where the synagogues were started when the Israelites were in exile in Babylon. They didn't have a temple anymore, so they started the synagogues where they would meet together in groups, and they would learn Torah. Okay, they would learn the law. Well, gradually, again, there came a need to translate the material for the hearer. The typical practice was that both would get read in the synagogue, both the Hebrew and the Aramaic. And the Aramaic, the Targum material, again, Targum just means translation. The Aramaic material was sort of used, developed as a commentary, an explanation of certain parts of the Torah, certain things that were read. So it's like a mini commentary. And what's significant about this is that I'm going to read another quote from Ronning's book, Jewish Targums and John's Logos Theology, his word, Jesus as the Word Theology. He writes, in hundreds of cases in the Targums, where the Masoretic text, again, the traditional Hebrew text, refers to God, the corresponding Targum passage refers to the Word. And in Aramaic, it's the Memra. Did you catch that? There are hundreds of places in the Targums where God does something or says something, where in the Targums, it's the Word. It's the Word of the Lord doing that thing or saying that thing. Considered against this background, Ronning writes, calling Jesus the Word is a way of identifying him with the God of Israel. Unquote. That's the end of the quote. Now, there's Old Testament precedent for this. It goes well beyond the Targums. Back into time, the Word of the Lord is an expression used to describe God himself in human form in the Old Testament. You've got Genesis 12, you've got 1 Samuel 3. You've got Jeremiah chapter 1, where the Word of the Lord comes to the prophet, and then a few verses later, the Word of the Lord reaches out his hand and touches the prophet's mouth. It's God in human form, in anthropomorphic form. God as man in the Old Testament, the Word of the Lord is one of the ways this is indicated. Now, that doesn't mean every time you have Word of the Lord in the Hebrew Bible that it's a anthropomorphic figure, like Jesus in the Old Testament or something like that. It doesn't mean that. It means that in certain contexts, though, there will be indications in the context that you actually have an anthropomorphic form, a human figure who is the Word of the Lord, who is Yahweh, but he's not the invisible transcendent Yahweh. There are passages where you have the Word of the Lord or the angel of the Lord where the name of the Lord is another way of expressing this in the same passage as God himself. So you actually have both figures in the same passage. They're two Yahwehs. They're two Yahweh figures. This is the antecedent, the kernel form of Godhead thinking in the Old Testament that's going to get, you know, amplified in the New Testament, especially with the incarnation when we have Jesus come, you know, born of a virgin, God as man, in the New Testament. I mean, the New Testament is where we develop this idea of a Godhead and specifically a Trinity. But this all starts in the Old Testament. And the word of the Lord is one of the ways this is expressed. Again, if you want details on this in a better systematic layout, you got to read Unseen Realm chapter 16 through 18. If you've already done that, you know exactly what I'm talking about here. But we're upping the ante here because now we're bringing the Targums into the picture, which I did not do in Unseen Realm, where you have this second anthropomorphic figure called the Word, called the Memra. It's the Aramaic word for word, in a particular scene in the Old Testament. So it happens all over the place. I'm going to read again from Ronning. He says, in the Targums, the divine word is usually indicated by a form of the Aramaic word Memra, which, when so used, is not a translation of anything in the Hebrew text. Rather, the phrase word of the Lord is often a circumlocution or substitute for the tetragrammaton, the four letters, you know, YHWH, Yahweh, the preeminent Old Testament name for God. It's another way of referring to God. That's the end of the Ronning quote. So in the Targums, when the Hebrew Bible reads Yahweh in many passages, the Targums will instead read Memra, or add the Memra of the Lord into the scene, thus identifying Yahweh as the Memra, the Word, or again creating this intermediate figure who is Yahweh but is also different from Yahweh, is but isn't, same but separate. You know, just like, again, this Godhead thinking of the New Testament where Jesus is God, but he's also Jesus of Nazareth, the man. He's both. So, again, these are Jewish antecedents to this idea. And I'm going to give you an example. In Genesis 3:8, you know, if in your Old Testament, I'm reading ESV, this is what you'd read. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. And then in verse 10, Adam says, you know, he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. So Genesis 3 has, again, 3:8 and 3:10 has the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. That's anthropomorphic because God doesn't have legs to walk. You know, God is a spirit. But he's described here in human form, walking around in the garden. Well, if you go to the Targums, same passage, Genesis 3:8, you read this. Then they heard the voice of the Memra of the Lord God walking in the garden towards the decline of the day. So Adam and his wife hid themselves from before the Lord God within a tree of the garden. It's not the Lord anymore, it's the Memra. Another Targum, this is Targum Neophiti. The first one was Targum Onkelos. And they heard it, the sound of the Memra of the Lord walking within the garden at the breeze of the day. Again, it's this second figure. Genesis 15:6, you have in the Hebrew Bible, you have the statement about Abraham, and he, Abraham, believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. You know, there's this scene where God comes to Abraham and makes him promises. He's going to make a covenant with him in Genesis 15. And then you read in verse 6, and he, Abraham, believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Well, guess what the Targums say? Targum Onkelos. And he, Abraham, trusted the Memra of the Lord. He trusted the Memra. He put his faith in the word of the Lord. Targum Neophiti. And Abram believed in the name of the Memra of the Lord, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Again, it's this God in human form. I mean, God is the word of the Lord. It's all over the place in the Targums. Now, I should make one comment here about the Targums. But before I get to that, I should mention it too, that the same thing, the same phenomenon about the word of the Lord being inserted in places. It happens occasionally in Second Temple texts, like Jubilees 2:1. can read that here. The angel of the presence spoke to Moses by the word of the Lord, saying, write the whole account of the creation, and in 6 days the Lord completed all his works. So in Jubilees, you have the word of the Lord, specifically the angel of the Lord, instructing and actually helping Moses write the creation story. Just one illustration. So this idea, again, is very old. It's as old as the Hebrew Bible. It's as old as Second Temple period literature. And it gets picked up in the Targums. Now, the Targums, as far as their dating, the date of the Targums relates to their manuscripts, but not their content. Their content is very ancient. Again, it goes back to the Hebrew Bible, this word of the Lord idea, Second Temple material like in Jubilees. The Targums, they actually get codified for and preserved, the ones we know about anyway, the ones we've recovered, scholars have recovered. They're usually 3rd or 4th century, you know, something like that in the Christian era. So they're later than the New Testament, but their content aligns with BC era sources, like, again, the Pseudepigrapha, some material in the Mishnah. Again, it's just that the Targums later get codified, but this was the practice in the early synagogues in Jesus' day and before, again, after the exile. You would have the Torah read in the synagogue, and you would have in Aramaic a rendering of that material. And that rendering would often include commentary. And that commentary would often include this figure, the Memra of the Lord. So now we take all this and we go back to Jude, you know, this idea of Jesus saving him from the Egyptians. Say, well, get that. Well, if you look at Exodus 3 in the Hebrew Bible, the burning bush incident, Exodus 3, 4, for example, when the Lord saw that Moses, you know, he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, he said, here am I. Now, we know from Exodus 3 that there's an angel in the bush. We went back and we read specifically the context. Let's just go here. So verse 4, God calls to him out of the bush. He says, here am I, do not come near. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. All of that we're familiar with is preceded by verse 2, which says, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. The angel is in the bush. Well, guess who's in the bush? In the Targums. I'll read it to you. This is from one of the Targums. I think it's Neofiti. He says, this is God speaking. I have been revealed in my Memra to deliver them, the Israelites, from the hands of the Egyptians, to bring them up from this land to a land good and broad, a land producing good fruits, pure as milk and sweet as honey, you know, to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, you know, the whole list there. The Targums actually have the word of the Lord delivering Israel from Egypt. And the word of the Lord, if we went back in Exodus 3, 4, the Targums, it's the Memra, the word of the Lord in the bush. Now, that sort of Jewish context ought to be a factor in how we interpret and judge Jude verse 5. The Jesus reading has solid manuscript support. It has won the day with important text critical authorities, and it is entirely consistent with the two powers, the two Yahwehs idea, that sort of thinking in Judaism. I mean, right there it is explicitly in the Targums. You have the word of the Lord. And John, remember, John calls Jesus the word of the Lord. John chapter 1. You have the word of the Lord delivering the Israelites out of Egypt. And Jude says, yeah, Jesus did that. Jesus did that. And that's all I wanted to talk about in this episode in relation to Jude 4 and 5. But again, I'm hoping you see the impact of this. It's very Jewish in context to read something as really shocking in the New Testament as Jesus being put right back in the Old Testament by Jude 5. But it's got the manuscript support, it's got the contextual support, it's consistent with Word of the Lord stuff, second power, second Yahweh stuff back in the Old Testament. And there you go. There it is in the New Testament. So again, for those of you who have read Unseen Realm and been exposed to this before, Again, I know when you talk with your friends about this, people look at you like you have two heads. Again, we're all used to that here. But right here it is in Jude 5. And if you want to explore the Jewish context of Jude 5 and, of course, John chapter 1, you get the Memra, the word of the Lord, this anthropomorphic God as man figure, substituted for Yahweh or inserted alongside Yahweh in the Jewish targums that everybody in Jesus' day grew up hearing who went to synagogue. I mean, it's a transparent context for the kind of things that I wrote about and I'm arguing for in Unseen Realms. So hopefully you found this interesting. Again, I think it's very useful and for apologetics. And again, just generally seeing the continuity across the Testaments. So next week, we'll move on from Jude chapter 5. I don't know how far we'll get because there's a lot in here. Jude 6, we'll probably spend the whole time on Jude 6 because it's the angels that sinned. I don't know. Spent a lot of time on that in Unseen Realms, so we may go beyond it. But again, it's just another example in this little letter of the really theologically significant stuff that's actually in it.
All right, Mike, this is becoming one of my favorite book studies so far. So we also
go ahead. Good stuff.
Yeah, it is good stuff.
I was going to say, it's good stuff.
Good stuff times 1,000. All right. Well, we want to remind everybody, hey, go support our sponsor, logos.com/nakedbible. Now's the time to get on Logos and support us, the show, and Logos, of course. It's the best Bible software tool out there. I think Mike would agree with that. True or false?
Yeah, true. And you know what? I'm reading from the Targums here. Guess what? I'm reading them in Logos. The Targums in English translation are one of the things, one of the book sets you can buy in Logos Bible software and find the material right there.
There you go. Go support our sponsor. We appreciate Logos for sponsoring us. And all right, Mike, looking forward to part 3 next week. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.